When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Early Modern History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Christina Brito, Associate Professor of History at Nova FCSH, Lisbon, and a researcher at the Center for Humanities at the same school, to talk about her new book, Humans and Aquatic Animals in Early Modern America and Africa, out this year, 2024, with the Amsterdam University Press. Hello, Christina, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Yana. Thank you so much for having me.
It is wonderful. We've had a little bit of a road getting here. Both of us were sick, and but we're here now and healthy and happy. So hurrah.
Yeah.
All right.
Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be sitting up and speaking as well, I'm sure. But, you know, it's a thing we shouldn't take for granted. Okay.
Not these days yet.
Yeah, so tell me, how did you come to write this book?
Okay, so let me start by saying that my background is in biology, marine biology. Okay. So I worked for a couple of years early on my career studying marine animals on the wild, and then I turned out to be an historian. So I did my PhD in early modern history of the European expansions in the world, so that period. But I was really focusing on the animals. So those animals that I used to study when I was a marine biologist, I was trying to find them and look for them and understanding them in the past. And kind of navigating the historical sources of that period. So I was working mostly with marine mammals, whales, dolphins, seals, sea lions, and then I came to the manatees or the sea cows. And that's how I came to the topic itself of the book. In this path of, you know, searching for animals on kind of the waves of history and how they would help me to understand how people's interacted, different societies interacted with marine environment.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I can see how you were trained as a marine biologist first. All right. Because first of all, the topic, the scope doesn't fit into our, like, how we kind of, you know, slice up our discipline, like the disciplinary boundaries. You work on early modern America and Africa, and that just doesn't happen. Those are Africanists and Americanists.
Yeah.
So that explains a little bit here. What was your thought process in connecting these two areas?
Yeah, I was trying to, the focus and the central piece are the animals themselves, and try to write a history or a narrative around the animals and how people interacted with them. And then, I'm sitting in Lisbon, I'm an European woman scholar, but I'm looking for and studying European sources, but I was really interested in understanding how other societies of that period understood and used and also communicate their relationships with marine animals. So using those sources, I was trying to understand kind of local practices, indigenous practices, traditional practices in the South Atlantic. That's my kind of geography. It's not hard because it is hard because we are, you know, looking for material that was written by Europeans for Europeans' consumption. at that period of time. So trying to show people in Europe how these other parts that were being taken and occupied and colonized were. And so it's really difficult to grasp local realities, but that's, as an historian or an environmental historian, that's my challenge. And, mm-hmm. and so I kind of connect, you know, Europe with West Africa and Central and South America.
You know, and it made sense. It makes sense to think about following the animals, right? When we're talking about sea mammals, they don't care about how African languages are different, and you'd have to learn a different like historiography. And if you treat the Atlantic and the South Atlantic as your territory, then the land that hits on it, it makes perfect sense. It's just, it seems like it probably made the book harder to write, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it does. It's more than a kind of a comparative study. I tried to encompass it all. It's kind of a global approach to the South Atlantic in that sense, where I try to find the similarities or, you know, convergences or divergences in the use of the animals and the perceptions about the animals. And they, in this case, if we were talking about whales, for instance, that migrate and move around, we could follow them. In this case, manatees or sea cows, they are kind of, they are local. They do move around, of course, but they are very coastal. They live near the shore or inshore waters. And that kind of conditions the way people interact with them, because they're there and they're part of their daily lives. Well, they were. Today mm-hmm. they are endangered species. But at that point, they were for sure much more abundant than they are today and distributed along large regions. And so people interacted with them kind of in a daily basis if they were using those same habitats and ecosystems where the animals lived in. So humans and non-humans from the aquatic environments kind of sharing their space, their environment, and being together, you know, co-constructing history and also ecology. So this mm-hmm. idea of eco-cultural systems that are built together, and that's something that we can focus on by working with the animals as subjects of our study.
And how do you get at these animals? What kind of sources do you use?
The typical sources that an historian would use to study, you know, early modern expansions and colonization. So kind of logbooks, travel diaries, general histories written for specific parts of the South Atlantic, natural history treaties, you know, letters, correspondence, also documents regarding imports and exports, so the consume of the animals, the value, the products that are extracted, and they are changed amongst the imperial scenario of the Portuguese and the Spanish empires of the time. Those are the documents that I'm looking for. And trying to understand the moment prior contact, and I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm not, even though I do like a lot material evidence and objects and animal bones and specimens in natural history museums, but I'm not a specialist on that. So I try to look for early sources for the moment of contact or confrontation between Europeans and American native societies or African societies. Try to see that moment where it was still possible to understand what was there before the influence and the impact and this great disruption produced by the European presence in non-European spaces. So these are my sources. So I do written sources, iconographic, you know, a lot of drawings, illustrations, and also a little bit of cartography. And all this together does allow us to put together a story that is very fragmented, and I need to fill in some holes and to make connections or bridge a couple of aspects, but all together just put together a nice story of how people interacted with the animals, what they meant, what the animals meant for people. And in this case, in the book, they were at the same time, that's what I came to realize, they could be at the same time a resource for food, for medicine, for use. They were an economic resource because they became very valuable for Europeans, both in colonial spaces as in Europe, but they were also pets for local people or local colonial societies. They had a symbolic meaning, so they were this kind of all-encompassing entity. They were more than their ecological reality.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great time then to ask about Mato the manatee.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about Mato. Who was he?
Yeah, Mato the manatee. So this is a story written early on, described as a manatee that was kept in an enclosed area, maybe a coastal lagoon that was close to the ocean, or a kind of man-made pool, so an aquatic environment that was said to be kept by the Taino people, or a group of the Taino from the Caribbean, or original native people from the Caribbean at the time that the Spaniards got to a couple of islands in the Caribbean basin. And the manatee Matu was said, Matu or Matum, was said to be kept by the cacique and was part of the family. And that kids would, or people there would sing to them or talk to them, and Matu would come to be fed by hand and would come close to shore. So this was the first description. And then several writers or scholars of the time, historians, humanists, kept repeating the story. And some said, so this is made up, this idea that people would see stuff that was not real. This is made up. It's not possible because, yeah, so. And others consider it was real. Anyhow, the story itself got reproduced several times. And it's present in the historical record. And many representations of this manatee within a lagoon are also found. And I found it very curious because even it really doesn't matter if it happened or not. The fact is that this manatee itself, so this individual, this animal, represented for a certain group of people. And I'm not saying that the Taino did not hunt manatees or consume them or use them as food. They most probably did. But at the same time, this animal itself was part of this human family, so an ecological connection between people and their environment. So it was fed, and it was really important for people, and at the same time represented this clash of the early modern societies, or different societies in the early modern period, which is Europeans, upon seeing the animal, as the story goes, would kind of poke him or stroke him, and the animal would be afraid of them. So it also represented the connection that different societies, indigenous societies, would have with animals, this idea of kind of a pristine relation to the environment, and how people coming from abroad and taking over the space, controlling the local people, the territories, but also the resources, would change everything. Because then the manatee, when he was seen by a Spaniard man that wanted to see if that's true, he stopped coming to the Taino. And then eventually the lagoon was open to the sea and the manatee was back to its kind of natural or original environment, which would be the sea or the shore waters of that region or the island. So the story, it's really detailed, and we can find it a bit everywhere up to current day when people talk about this. And it's really a good example. So it was the kind of the motive for me to start writing the book. And it, you know, just goes across all the chapters in the book. Mm-hmm. Just to give it kind of continuity.
Yeah, like there's these ways Mato the manatee reflects kind of your whole story.
Yeah,
right. It's and this thing, you know, I found myself trying to categorize this relationship. Is he a pet? Is he their friend? Is he actually a captive the whole time? Right, like
yeah. The thing is, people do keep manatees in captivity. They can survive very well. They are very coastal. They live in shallow waters. And there are, when I went to see if this could be a possibility, it is, in fact, because they are well, today in places where they are endangered, if a manatee is found, you know, stranded or hurt, people will take them in, take care of them, and then kind of rehabilitate them, and then just send them out again to their environment, and they live well within confined areas. So this is a possibility. This is not something that's strange. It could happen, in fact. So it could be something that a manatee could endure and survive for many years. So it could be something there. And then we really cannot tell about people's emotions or feelings. Well, we cannot tell them about them today. How can we kind of address them in the past? We can try, but we are not really sure if this kind of intimate relationship, kind of a connection with an animal like this could happen. I would say so. Yeah, I think it's possible.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, as you noted, the what happened, we can't really get at, and it doesn't matter anyway. Yeah. The point is that there's this story that still resonates.
Yeah.
Much like, you know, in your second chapter, you talk about mysterious water creatures, like, you know, like the mermaid. Mm-hmm. And does the mermaid exist matters less than what the mermaid means, right?
Exactly. The mermaid, studying mermaids, it's been kind of transversal to my research, because when I started doing this, I was thinking, like, you know, mermaids are part of a narrative that still, well, in Europe at least, when people are not familiar with these animals that are from subtropical or tropical bioregions of the world, and then when they would come to know the animals, either manatees, dugongs, or I don't know, other species of seals or felines, when Europeans would get to know the animals, kind of the myth of the mermaid would vanish. That was my reasoning about this many, many years ago. And of course, this is not true. So mermaids as a myth, they are pervasive along history. They cross cultures, they cross geographies. Again, up to the present day, there are people that still believe in them. And that really doesn't matter. So the fact this entity, this more than human or hybrid entity, is really important for many cultures. And for the part of the world that I study and the time of our human history that I study, the mermaid is important, is relevant, it represents the mermaid in its kind. It's not just the mermaid as we conceive them today. So it's this water deity that can be represented in multiple formats and ways and have multiple meanings. But it does represent a connection and kind of a dependency of humans with the aquatic environment. And in many parts there, also the distribution of this myth, they are connected with aquatic animals, and mostly for almost all the cases, probably manatees. That's how we came to the Mamiwata construction, mm-hmm. which is an African deity that was transported with enslaved people from West Africa, brought to the Americas, and the Mamiwata is still today venerated, how do you say it? It's part of the cults in the Caribbean as well as in Africa. And it can also connect it to the Brazilian Yemanja or Yara, many other water deities that are important today for people.
Mm-hmm. So the mermaid reflects kind of a relationship, a kind of a happy relationship, or
it has a dual meaning, I think.
Is there something, because I feel like there's a gendered component here somehow, that it's about mermaids and very little about mermen
if we go through the sources, we'll find as much mermaids as mermen. So merwomen and mermen, they are present. And this construction of this feminine mermaid as we conceive it today, it's much centered in our kind of European matrix of thinking and ways of understanding the world. So the mermaid is hybrid in all its meanings, from the water and the air. It's human and it's a fish. It's also a woman or a man or something in between. And that's also very interesting to address, that this, even though we call it mermaid, it could be a non-gendered figure. And it could have multiple meanings regarding to that aspect in different societies. And it also connects very well to the manatee, because the animal is itself kind of also hybrid, because it has this also dual or multiple meanings that are attached to itself. Being aquatic is also very coastal and connected to land. It feeds on algae, but also on plants from the shores. It lives in water, but needs to come to the surface to breathe, as a mammal that it is. It nurses its calves, so there's all these connections to kind of an hybridity. And the mermaid also encloses all these multiple meanings. She, he, or they can be good or bad. They can represent all the possibilities of the ocean, but also all the dangers. So it's and I think that's why it's so transversal to so many cultures, because it encompasses a lot of what is human nature. It's kind of a reflection or a mirror of humans in all its complexities across time.
So what's the difference between a mermaid or a merperson and then these sea monsters?
Well, there are many representations of different sea monsters. They all kind of represent the same, these paradoxes of the ocean, of the deep sea, of the horizon, what's far away, what can be found or not. But they include, the thing is, sea monsters usually are part of what people does not understand in the ocean. So they can include their own representations of views of the world, and then people just put together this bunch of parts of marine animals that they have never seen or they are not familiar with to construct this idea of a monster. And in history, sea monsters have a very clear purpose. Either do not come to this part of the world, or on this represent dangers, or this on the other end, it could represent abundance and diversity somehow. And sometimes they mean that people do not understand exactly what they are seeing in that part of the world or the ocean. And on the other hand, if we go to the natural history process of construction in Europe, sometimes people knew that they were making up animals. So monsters in some way could be fake news of the time, if you will. They have a background of truth, either mythological, religious, or symbolic, and ecological, so from the biology point of view, but then they are kind of a confusion. Everything is messed up. And sometimes they were produced just to catch attention of people on a topic. The idea was to attract their attention to a subject by showing people something that was strange, that was new, that was exotic, even if it was not real.
So there are a couple things that I'm thinking. This brings up to mind, you know, the idea that just like over there is scary stuff. Yeah. You know, when we think about early travel narratives, there are dragons. The Amazons live on the other side of that mountain. Like, there are giant snakes in the sea. But then there are giant snakes in the sea. There are actually, you know, giant alligators or something in the New World, right? So it's a fear, but it's based on something known, right?
Yeah, something that's true, something that's out there in some cases, but in others, not so much. And what you see sometimes is that animals are represented considering their real features, their real behavior and distribution, alongside with mythical creatures, alongside with sea monsters, and they have a certain purpose. So they respond to a narrative. They respond to a request of a public, of the audience, in some domains. having said that, in societies that are not European, so local, traditional, indigenous, there are also sea monsters or aquatic monsters or monstrosities, and they can be constructed again for multiple purposes. So there's this monster there, don't go there. They could be a way of kind of, how can I put it, to control people's relationships with nature in terms of extraction and consumption, kind of a taboo. Mm-hmm. So to speak. So these constructions are part of the way humans deal with their natural surrounds, with what they understand and they do not, and also what they want to control or not. And sometimes aquatic monsters or other monstrosities of nature could be a way of controlling, of categorizing, of saying, don't go beyond these boundaries or these categories. So this is the norm and this is out of the norm. This could be also a way of setting people alongside a path or a route. And this is not just in our kind of European matrix of knowledge, of religion, and of science, so to speak, for that period. It's part of many other worldviews across mm-hmm. the world.
It seems just to be a way that humans are going to deal with something as incomprehensible as the ocean.
Yeah. It's really the great unknown, the great out there, the great depths. Again, we have to keep in mind that humans, that different societies have seen the ocean very differently from one another. For some, it could be really a place to go and explore and discover and use, and for others. And for many cultures for this period in West Africa, the ocean would be a place of fear, of death, and not a place of abundance. So people react to the ocean very differently. But I think that the ocean is really contradictory even today. It's still the great unknown. So the great depths are still very much unknown to us. Mm-hmm. And I can only assume, and when I'm out in the ocean and I know, you know, you look to the world around you when you are in the sea, far away from the shore, and there's this enormous mass of water and possibilities and darkness below us. Mm-hmm. And that might have been very scary for people at different time periods and moments.
Sure. We don't know. We still don't know what's out there.
We don't know, yeah.
No.
You know, if you're... It's so much mystery out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And if you're on the coast of West Africa, which is a really hostile coast, sailing is dangerous, you know, as opposed to the Mediterranean or...
Yeah. Yeah, that's really important. So the kind of the biogeography, the oceanography of certain places also impacts on how people represent and understand the ocean.
Mm-hmm. I see this, the ocean itself and the monsters and the creatures that live in it, monsters, friends, whatever. They just represent this relationship with the ocean as right, in a lot of ways. Okay, one more thing I want to talk about before we go is you bring up the idea, you coin a phrase, as near as I can tell, nature culture.
Mm.
Yeah, tell me about nature culture.
Well, that's a concept. It's debated today, but my idea is it was try to understand. As I told you in the beginning of the conversation, so I'm a trained marine biologist and then a trained historian. And when I started, when I was studying animals in the wild, I was studying behavior, bioacoustics, so populations, a little bit of cognition and culture. And when I came to study humans, my supervisor, and then I would go and say, so human population, because for me there was also an animal population, or human culture. Then my supervisor would say, no, when you say population, it's always human. So these differences between disciplines and kind of not conflicting, but really different ways of using words and concepts and understanding scientific ideas from the natural sciences and the human sciences were always there. And for a while earlier on my career, I tried to separate these two worlds, the natural world and the cultural world, for me to understand what I was doing and to address in a new methodological ways, well, these questions. And then as I get along and I go back to the animals and how people interact with them, I came to understand, of course, as many other scholars do, that it's not possible, in my view, in my perspective, to separate human from nature. So human is nature, nature is human, we are part of a system. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I try to see how could I kind of enclose at the same time ecological and historical and cultural perspectives. And that's how I came to this idea of nature culture, which is discussed by Bruno Latour, Donna Haraway, many other scholars, even today in different disciplines, and how eco-cultural systems, more than just ecosystems, could be addressed. So the idea of a connected ecological and cultural world where humans, of course, are part of ecosystems and trophic nets of our world, even if they are a top predator and deeply impacting nature and ecosystems and other species, but also animals and other species being part of historical narratives, more than just subjects, considering that animals and ecosystems and even the ocean itself could be seen as an agent, or they have agency, so they can be actors in the construction of history. So there is no history, no human history without the other species. That's my perspective. So this idea of the nature cultural system or the eco-cultural system grows from this. And it's something that many people within environmental history, environmental humanities, and other areas are discussing today. We impact each other, we depend on each other, and there's no way to address, well, even today, current day societal or environmental issues without considering these aspects as entangled. And of course, the past is the same.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so I've taken up a bunch of your time already, so I have just one more question, which is what's next? What are you working on now?
I do like a lot to study marine mammals in the past, in the oceans and their connections with people. I've been doing the Atlantic, the South Atlantic for many years now. And I really want to kind of go global with this perspective, try to see if there's this continuity in understanding these animals in other societies, in different times, in different temporal and cultural contexts. So I'm trying to move from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean and the Indo-Pacific to study kind of manatee cousins, which are the dugongs. So mm-hmm. I think I will stick with the Sirenia, this group of animals, of sea cows, and we'll start again to review Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch, English sources for that region of the world to see if there are similarities and try again to address how local people have studied the animals. I am, again, assuming that's something that we do when we start research. I'm assuming that would be very similar to what peoples of the Atlantic, so to speak, would have done with the animals and do today. But all the species of Sirenia today, the three species of manatees, the dugongs, they are threatened, they are endangered. And I think it's really important also to bring this historical information, quantitative information that we can extract from the sources to current day conservation and management. So not just going to other oceanic basin, but also trying to impact current day conservation with the use of historical data and sources. I think the humanities for the ocean, as I call them, the humanities can contribute to ocean science, and that's my kind of next step. Let's see what that will bring.
Oh, that sounds wonderful and really interesting. Yeah, and just looking at, you know, these sheer numbers when we're talking about the die-off that, you know, in the Anthropocene has got to be useful.
Yeah, the Anthropocene is also something that I'm really interested in studying, not just the Anthropocene of the 20th century, the Great Acceleration, but also going back to this early modern period and kind of the early globalization, the early impacts, the early extinctions. And these animals are in fact, a good subject to do that, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Oh, Christina, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk again soon. When you have your next book, we'll have a chat.
Sure.
Take care.